When I came back to Virginia from Hong Kong, I didn't tell my parents what had happened. My mother embraced me when she picked me up from the airport. I could feel the edges of her body against mine. She felt more fragile than I remembered. Back in Virginia, I felt suspended, out of place. It was as though time had passed in a world outside, but when I'd come back, everything was still the same, like it had all been a dream. I decided to play the violin on Sundays at a local retirement home for Alzheimer's patients. "What a treat," one of the nurses would say every time I came in. The home was a beautiful white Victorian building surrounded by a wraparound veranda that was always empty. The gardens were deserted as well. Inside the home were several floors. On the bottom floor, residents sat in the main living room watching the television. I went up in the lift, past the coated locks on the doors. I was assigned the sunshine room, the place for the most advanced patients. The atmosphere in the sunshine room was chaotic. Nursery rhymes played over the stereo. There was a constant hum of noise, sometimes screaming and shouting, but it felt like there was nowhere for the sound to escape. Most of the residents sat in the living room, a small carpeted room in the middle of the ward. The residents wouldn't speak to one another. They spoke to the nurses sometimes. Some would sit with dolls on their laps, others with newspapers and magazines, flipping through the pages as though they knew this was what you did with a page. They would watch me as I rosined my bow and placed the violin under my chin. There was no accompaniment, no announcement of when I should begin. I would just stand and play, and the room would fall into silence. The violin and the songs were transportive. The residents would sit patiently and listen to the simple songs. Tennessee Waltz, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, Amazing Grace. If a song seemed popular, I'd play it again, sometimes three times. It didn't matter that they'd heard it before. Sometimes they would clap, other times they'd forget to. Some would sing along. One woman knew the words to every song. She would cry when I played Danny Boy. They would all ignore the woman screaming as she pushed her walker. Playing the violin was transportive for me too. As I played the simple melodies, I would close my eyes and think of childhood days, of fireflies and kites. I was bringing something beautiful into a place that was ugly. It was like I'd found a way to exit time. Somehow the residents always knew that I was a visitor from the outside world. Even if they weren't sure of who I was, they knew that I was from someplace else. They would take turns talking to me. Each wanted some time to ask me questions. They'd wait impatiently for their turn. One of the women would always touch my hair. "So long," she'd say, and then she'd touch her own cropped hair. Another would ask me to spin while she clapped and pronounced my outfit perfect. There was a colonel who liked to tell me about his beef cattle farm. He knew exactly how many of each breed he had and on how many acres. There was another woman who used to sing opera in the great houses. "I'm here because my daughter needs me to be close by," she said to me in a confiding tone. "It's hard, but you have to do what's best for your children." There was a woman who always had a handbag on her lap. I don't know what it was filled with, but she clutched it to her side fiercely. "She's always prepared, ready to go home," one of the nurses explained. She laughed, but I didn't. I was drawn to their stories, but mostly I was drawn to this place where time didn't exist. It was a place of memory, of loss, but each treasured memory lasted only for the moment. "Who is that?" someone would ask, pointing at their reflection in the shiny case of my violin. They never asked who I was or whether we'd met before. Perhaps they were afraid of the answer. They all told me that today was the day they were going to go home. I think of us, the residents in this ward, how desperately we want to leave this place. How would it feel to forget, only to remember each time that there was no plan to leave? There are barred doors on each side of the psych ward, like the points of a compass, except that they lead nowhere. In Virginia, I found a job working as a lobbyist on Capitol Hill in a crumbling townhouse surrounded by white marble buildings. I found riding the metro into work every day depressing. The brutalist architecture of the metro stations felt oppressive and harsh, and working under the shadow of the Capitol building, I was reminded how much of my work was pushing paper. I worked for a woman with a stretched Botox leather face. She would chew ice cubes in an effort not to be hungry. She was a leading fundraiser for one of the political parties, and her mind had a huge capacity for remembering the names of the wealthy and the famous, although she had trouble with mine, even though we saw each other every day. I moved out of my parents' house and into a small apartment in Clarendon. My roommate was a federal employee who I discovered had a drinking problem. It took me all of a week to figure this out. She drank pints of vodka disguised in a colorful plastic cup with lemonade and a straw. We never talked about it, how she never went out or saw any friends, but would sit in front of the television and watch reality TV and drink until she passed out. I'd escape the apartment at weekends. I didn't have any friends in Washington, D.C., and so I spent my Saturday afternoons at the arrivals terminal at Reagan National Airport. I'd always loved airports. There was a feeling of possibility, of excitement. The arrivals terminal was my favorite, and so I'd read a book on the metro and go to the airport to watch the planes fly in. I sat there for hours, watching the people come through, like waves in a stormy sea. I loved watching the reunions. I loved the look of expectation on someone's face before the recognition, the embrace between loved ones. I'd imagine what their stories were. Who were they? Where had they been? Now they were returning. The reunion seemed so beautiful. It was like the resolution of a discordant chord, a perfect ending, a closing of the loop. It reminded me of a Korean documentary program that showed families reuniting from North and South, a select few who had been chosen and allowed to make contact. It was difficult to watch. Most of them were sobbing so hard they couldn't speak, their lives interrupted by separation and uncertainty. Brother, they'd shout. Husband, wife, my daughter. You're alive, you're alive. I've been waiting. My mother used to watch this program and sob. Can you imagine, she'd say. Can you imagine? I don't know exactly who my grandparents had left behind. They disappeared from the stories, leaving only a faint trace, not even a full memory. I'd hear fragments of their stories over the years, whispers of wives and husbands, children left behind. It was like they existed in a parallel place, just on the other side of the border, waiting. Can you imagine? My mother had asked me, and I couldn't. How do you live without knowing, with a life interrupted and no resolution? How do you live in a suspended moment? How do you live as a ghost? We stand in the cafeteria line at 12 o'clock for lunch. There's Arizona diet tea on the tables again. My teeth feel filmy from the diet tea. It tastes metallic, like stale sugar. I've started brushing my teeth every few hours to try to get rid of the taste. We wait in line as Jeff and Ronnie put on gloves to serve food. The meal today is pizza. I get two round discs. I sit at one of the back tables by the door, next to Darren and Ali. At the table behind us is the blind girl with flaking skin. Her face is bright red and rubbed raw. I try not to stare, but in a room of blurred faces, all I can do is see hers. I can tell the others feel the same way. We make an effort to look away. She stays in her room except for mealtimes. She sits in a wheelchair and has a 24-hour caregiver who sits next to her, wearing blue plastic gloves. She asks her caregiver to tear up her food into small pieces. They have to be bite-sized and triangular, she says. She uses her hands to check and make sure they are the right size. Mick also has a caregiver. He hired one to make sure none of you thugs jump me, as he put it. He smiled when he said it, but it sounded a lot like a warning. Darren just snorted, but Emmett, a young athlete with a bright smile, scowled at him. I learned that having a caregiver is a sign of status. It's an added expense. Mick has one because of his veteran benefits, but I'm not sure why Dave doesn't have one. Perhaps he didn't have someone to help him fill in the paperwork. I can't finish my pizza, and Darren gestures to me to ask if he can have mine. I nod. The workers frown. I realize I've broken a rule. The mood in the cafeteria is tense. I notice that more workers have been gathering in the doorways, watching silently, their earpieces tucked around their necks. Jeff and Ronnie are standing in the front of the cafeteria with their arms crossed, watching us eat. Tamira accidentally kicks Mick's wheelchair. Watch it, welfare queen, he says. He laughs, but Tamira doesn't. Sam, a new kid, starts banging his fists on the table. Respect your elders, Tamira snaps. There is a moment when it feels like something's about to break, and I hold my breath and count. One of the workers tells Tamira to take a walk, and the feeling disappears. "Cat, phone," Darren shouts for me. I'm sitting in the activity room. There are markers and crayons scattered around the table. I'm writing in my notebook. I'm trying to remember everyone's names. I cover the paper with my hands, hoping that no one can read over my shoulder. My pen is starting to run out of ink. I tuck the notebook under my arm and shuffle over to the hallway for the payphone. I feel eyes on me. "Hello?" "Hello, Kat?" The voice is faint, familiar. It's James's voice. I take a deep breath and try to remember. James. He is my husband. This is my husband's voice. "Hi," I say. "I'm so happy to talk to you," he says. He sounds like he's on the verge of tears. I want to reassure him, reach out to him, but instead I close my eyes and listen. He's asking me questions. "Are you eating okay? Are you sleeping okay? Are people treating you well? They've said that you have your own room. You do, right?" The questions are spilling around me and I can't focus. I hear his words pouring over me, and all I can concentrate on is his voice. His voice sounds like it's coming from a far distance. Where is he? I remember hearing his voice during my psychosis. It was always there, as though he was just out of reach. I listen. "I'm going to come visit, okay? I'll be there tomorrow. That's the next visiting session. I came to visit you yesterday, but you were sleeping, so they wouldn't let me see you." I feel like my mind is trying to catch up. I hadn't realized that there were visiting hours. "When are you coming?" "Tomorrow night at 5:30. I'll be there," he says. Cato is next to me right now. Can you hear him? And I hear the sound of a baby cooing. My breath catches in my throat. I want to weep, but I also can't feel anything. My mind feels like there's a door, opening and closing, opening and closing. Cato. "We miss you," James says. He hangs up. I hang up slowly. I can feel tears caught in my eyes, but they aren't heavy enough to fall. I'll be seeing James tomorrow. I know that I should be excited, but I feel numb. Somewhere there is a spark of emotion, but I can't access it. When I go back to the activity room, I look again at my family tree. James. Husband. I met my husband, James, at a wedding in New Jersey. It had been many months since Hong Kong. I was still working in Washington, D.C. as a lobbyist. I was living back at my parents' home. I'd moved out of the apartment with my alcoholic roommate. It had become untenable. She would drink until she passed out on the floor, her plastic cups rolling around under the couch. I found out that because she had security clearance, she also had access to a gun in the apartment, and that's when I decided to go. I was ready to leave my job as well. I had been trying to figure out the best way to quit without any blowback, and I was almost ready to pull the trigger. Hong Kong seemed like a scene from someone else's life, although sometimes my cheekbone hurt, and then I'd be reminded of the bruises underneath the surface. It was a few weeks before the wedding when my friend, the bride, said that I should meet one of the groomsmen. "He's a professor," she said. I pictured a serious-looking man with elbow patches on his clothes. "But he breakdances. I think you guys would get along," she said. "He lives in London." I learned that James was a Korean-American from New Jersey. He lived in Oxford before moving to London, and he was doing research in something sciencey. I was reluctant. I didn't need to meet another man who lived across an ocean, and I knew Korean-American New Jersey boys. They were a dime a dozen, I thought. I'd find out later that James initially refused to meet me as well. "I live in London," he said. "I don't do long distance." But it was cocktail hour at the wedding. We'd heard the vows. The sun was beginning to set, and the couple was ready for magic hour. One of my friends dragged me over to introduce me to James. I was surprised to see a boy. He was tall with a shaggy haircut, and he had a playful smile. He was laughing with a group of people, but I noticed that he held himself differently, like he was standing slightly apart. In his hand was a glass of bourbon, shining in the cut glass. "Hello," he said, and he beamed at me like we were friends. His smile was wide and his eyes were kind. I saw myself reflected in them. It felt as though he was throwing a rope to me, like I hadn't realized that I'd been alone at sea, and suddenly there was someone who recognized me. James would tell me that he felt like he was being seen for the first time in his life. We saw each other. I don't remember what my friend said to introduce us, but we started to talk, slowly and then with increasing speed. We talked about London, about the theater, about museums. We talked about our childhoods. He told me about being a kid in New Jersey, his culture shock when he moved to Michigan for university. I told him about Kentucky, about my days with Teddy in the backyard. As we talked, we forgot about the wedding. James almost missed his groomsman duties. He was pulled away just in time. Around us were the lights and the whirl of the wedding. I could glimpse the last rays of sunset and hear the sounds of music and dancing. As he left, he turned back towards me and smiled and waved. "I'll come find you later," he said. And I knew that he would. What was it about James? There was something disarming about him. When I had more time to think about it in the days after the wedding, I'd realized that he was the most sincere person I'd ever met. He was completely open, unapologetically himself. "I'm flying back tomorrow morning," he said to me when he found me later. "Tomorrow morning?" I thought. "That's no time at all." But he smiled at me and looked so calm that I tried to ignore the time, counting the hours slowly to make each moment last longer. The wedding passed in stages, the bride's first dance with her father, her waltz with her husband, the courses of chicken and beef, the speeches, cocktails, but we were suspended, caught in the moment we had met. And because we only had one night, we spent it together talking. I learned about James's vision, his dream to create non-invasive surgery using ultrasound. He told me about his family, a large clan spread across California and New York, their weekly dinners and summers of barbecues and pool parties. I learned that his father was slightly deaf, and I laughed. He was the son of a deaf man, and I was the daughter of a blind man. "What's your dream?" he asked me. "I don't have one," I said, "but I wish I did." I wanted some of his certainty, some of his hope and drive for the future. I realized that he was always looking ahead, looking to the future, while I was fascinated by the past, reliving memories again and again. And so, with the future and past together, each hour passed like a dream. We were existing outside of time. He never mentioned the future to me, although I could tell he was thinking about it. He'd give me an appraising look, as if trying to guess if I was thinking what he was thinking. At one point, he suddenly said to me, "So we're really going to do this?" "What do you mean?" I asked. "We're going to date, even though I live in London and you're here." I laughed. "Why not?" And he laughed too. James would tell me later that he fell in love with me at first conversation. "The room seemed to blur," he said, "and all I could see was you. We had good rhythm," he said. And we did. The way we talked, the way the conversation flowed. It was familiar, like the well-known notes of an old song. The next morning, James flew back to London. He'd given me his email address, his mobile and office phone numbers, his website, and home and office addresses. There would be no excuse, he said. He'd call me when he landed in London. "I've been thinking of you," he said. "I was thinking of you on my flight back, and I'm thinking of you now." He asked me to visit him in London. I agreed to visit a month later after I'd quit my job. I'd already promised myself that I would quit, but the trip to London gave me a reason to make sure I kept my promise. While we waited for my trip, we talked for hours on the phone and on FaceTime. We played questions where we had to guess the other's answer to a question we posed. What was our favorite part of the day? What did we most look forward to? What was our idea of a perfect date? We planned outings, imagined a list of places we'd go when I was in London, have ice cream on the Millennium Bridge, visit the Tate Modern, watch a play at the National Theater, walk through Richmond Park. We treasured each like there were already memories. There was beauty in the waiting. I packed my bag for 6 weeks. It was autumn in London. As I boarded, I touched the side of the plane for good luck. I felt a sense of repetition, a recurrence. But it wasn't, was it? This time I was flying across the Atlantic to someone new. At the airport, I saw James waiting at the arrivals gate. I tried to think of how we looked to the people around us. All those times I'd sat and watched couples like us reunite. I had never known their stories, but I had wondered about them at that moment, the moment of two lives intersecting. I suddenly felt shy and uncertain. What was I doing? Did I even know this guy? I'd only known him for 12 hours, and here I was. We were going to spend 6 weeks together. He was smiling. His hair was still shaggy. I paused, hesitant, and he stepped forwards to embrace me. When he embraced me, all doubt disappeared. We stayed in his studio apartment near Hyde Park. James presented me with two notebooks, one for me and one for us to write in together. "For our adventures," he said. London became our playground. We went through our list of dates, savoring each moment that had before been only imaginary. We lounged and drank coffee at cafes, walked hand in hand through Hyde Park, wandered through museums of gilded stone and marble. Each moment felt precious. We knew it was temporary, and so we held on to them. But throughout, we talked. We had conversations. James loved conversations, he told me. His house had been a noisy one, full of voices and clamoring, and as the youngest, he had never been given a chance to speak. It was chaotic, which he loved, but he'd longed for silence. I thought that was funny. It was like the inverse of my house, where the silence was oppressive. I'd longed for noise. Falling in love with James had a rhythm. It was as though we'd always been existing on the same plane, like we were reflections of each other. When I returned from London, we both knew that our future was to be together. James asked if I would move to London, but I told him that I couldn't move for someone again. He was disappointed, but he said he understood. "I just need more time," I said. This was Hong Kong all over again, one of my friends warned me. I also saw the patterns. Like Drew, James represented possibility. He lived across an ocean. He was asking me to move for him. But why was I so convinced that James was different? How did I know? It went beyond James being different from Drew. I understood that for James, there was truth. He was clear-sighted, a true scientist. And just as my mother had known that with my father, his love for her would be clear, I knew that with James, everything would be logical and proven. James saw life as something to build, to create, and I knew that a life with him would be one which we would create together, without any predetermined rules. James loved to live in the moment. "Let's take in this moment," he'd say, and we'd breathe in, taking in the sounds, the smells, the stillness in the air. He helped me capture time. I felt so happy with James, I couldn't help but wonder what the cost would be. What would the fates decide would be the price of feeling pure joy? My grandmother's warning was in my ears, but I pushed away the feeling and the doubt. I decided to believe. I met James's family at Christmas time. Their house in New Jersey was decorated with tinsel and plastic lights. James's mother was tall like him, lean, with a continual moving energy. Her normal state was one of perpetual motion. She was a homemaker who was devoted to her three sons. James was the youngest, the baby of the family, and her unquestioned favorite. He was the only one who had her love of adventure, she said. James's father was a pediatrician with a private practice in New York. He was jolly, with a booming laugh and a constant smile. He was a devout Christian. He loved to show us Pinterest quotes about faith, and he had Bible verses painted on the walls of the house. I was initially nervous to meet them. I knew the rules of a Korean daughter-in-law. I was meant to be subservient and obedient, quiet and never questioning of authority. It was obvious that they knew the rules too, but I soon learned that I wasn't expected to play the game. They were welcoming, warm and excited to meet the girl that James had brought home. James had told them we had fallen in love at first conversation, but they didn't seem concerned about the speed of our meeting. Perhaps it was because they had married a week after they'd met. It was an arranged marriage. We spoke in English, which eliminated the need for the formal tense in Korean, and they treated me as a friend rather than a daughter-in-law that they could scold. "What are the qualities you look for most in a man?" James's father asked me. I thought for a moment. I thought of Drew, and I thought of James. What was it that I saw in James? "I would like three things," I said. "Kindness, loyalty, and conviction." He laughed heartily. "Conviction? James has a lot of conviction. That can make life difficult." He looked thoughtful. "But he has kindness." I would meet the rest of James's family over the Christmas period, a loud, raucous clan. It was exhilarating. Cousins, aunts, uncles, all in one house in New Jersey. We played card games and drank beer. There were always tables of food. We'd eat with styrofoam plates on our laps. Children would run screaming through the rooms, and the grown-ups would shout and laugh. One afternoon, James asked me to walk outside with him. "I need a moment," he said. "It's too much." We put on our coats and walked in the cold air, trudging along the snowbanks, looking at the houses draped in Christmas lights. I took James to my home to meet my parents. We took the train down to Washington, D.C. It was like entering a different world. My parents' house was monastic, quiet. The silence echoed off the wooden floors. My father asked James to step closer so that he could see him. "I can't see well," he explained, and he took off his glasses and looked at James hard. James didn't seem nervous. He talked with my father about mathematics and the piano. My father seemed relieved, in his element, while my mother chatted excitedly with me over tea. At one point, I said to James, "It's so quiet, it must be strange." "No, I like it," James said. "I can think." And we greeted the new year in silence. No television or ball drop, just the distant sound of fireworks in the background. After quitting my job and starting freelance work, I decided to move to New York. I moved into a small living room in Queens, where I slept on the floor in a sleeping bag. New York was sprawling, anonymous but familiar, always an open city for whoever seeks refuge. I met up with James's mother often in the city. It began as a whim. She called me to ask if I wanted to get coffee. She took me to a cafe in Little Italy, where we wandered the alleyways until we found the place she swore had the best pastries. We had espressos and shared cannoli. Spending time with her reminded me of James. She told me that she loved to take the bus into New York and wander the neighborhoods on her own. She would choose a new neighborhood to explore, and she'd enter every single shop, walk down the back streets, and get lost. "James would follow me when he was little," she said. "He loved to walk with me." She sounded wistful. We started to meet often in the city. She took me to the coffee shops she loved in the Bronx, where we'd share hot buns and empanadas. We sat in a booth and listened to the chatter of Spanish. "It reminds me of Argentina," she said. "It's where I grew up." I learned that she had left Korea when she was 13. Her mother was the one who decided that she would have an arranged marriage. Her mother had chosen James's father because he was a doctor and a Christian, elements of a good husband. "I feel lucky to be with him," she said. "He's a good man." She smiled at me. We did have our occasional misunderstandings. James's mother had a habit of making comments and criticisms that would stay under my skin. "Why are you wearing this?" she asked me once when I came to a family birthday party wearing flats. "We need to go shopping so that you can make a good impression." I found out later that she was concerned that I hadn't made a good impression on her mother-in-law, James's grandmother. Why didn't I care more about what people thought? Her comments and implications frustrated me. I had thought I didn't have to contend with the rules, but I could feel the burden of tradition, the borders coming down, and the generations of expectation weighing on me. But the comment that bothered me the most was that I needed to learn to surrender. "When you're married, you have to adapt," she'd warned me. "You have to surrender." "I surrender" was her most common phrase. She'd say it and laugh when she talked about her husband or her sons. "Why?" I'd think. "Why surrender?" And I'd think to myself, I'd refuse, no matter what. I didn't mention my annoyance to my mother because I knew what she would say. She would just be angry and tell me that she'd warned me about mothers-in-law, and she'd tell me the Korean stories about their cruelty. "In-laws," she'd say, and her eyes would flash darkly. I remembered her story about my father's family. On a visit after her marriage, she'd gone alone to their house to help prepare for my grandfather's 60th birthday. They took her passport and kept her in their house against her will, intending to train her to be a good wife and daughter-in-law. When they finally let her return to the U.S., she had to be hospitalized, whether for exhaustion or stress, I'm not sure. My father refused to speak to them for years. So whenever James's mother talked about surrendering, I'd think of the Korean folktales. I'd think of my mother and her stories. But then James's mother and I would laugh again over coffee, and I'd wonder if I'd only imagined the tension. Meanwhile, James and I took turns visiting one another. I washed dishes at parties, tutored, and freelanced to save money for my flights. Each time I visited London, it would feel like no time had passed at all. There had been a parallel existence waiting for me. It was a strange feeling. I no longer knew where home was. Each time I stepped inside the airport, it was like stepping through a doorway. James proposed later that year. It was spring, and the trees were tipped with frost. He gave me a journal he'd been keeping for months about our relationship, and a ring that shone like a star. When James asked my mother if he should ask my father for permission to marry me, she told him not to bother. It's Catherine's decision. We called Teddy to tell him the news. He was hiking in Nepal. "Cool," he said. His voice sounded wistful over the phone. My mother seemed happy for me, for us. Neither of my parents commented that James was a professor like my father, and if they saw any similarities in our stories, they kept it quiet. My mother never asked me why it didn't work out in Hong Kong. She seemed to accept that it was a closed door. James and I were married exactly a year from the day we met, at City Hall in San Francisco. We chose San Francisco by chance because it was the location of another friend's wedding. James flew in from London, and I flew in from New York. We went to the friend's wedding, where we danced to jazz and cheered for the slow-motion camera booth. The next day, dressed in the outfits we'd been wearing on the night we met, we took a taxi to City Hall. James looked nervous in his tux and groomsman tie, and I was wearing a black and white dress. I was holding hydrangeas that I'd taken from the centerpieces at our friend's wedding. They were a shade of pale blue. It was just the two of us and two friends as witnesses. I felt nervous and shaky. I tried breathing, slow counts. As we climbed the stairs of City Hall, I remembered the moment we'd met. I thought of us as children, James, the youngest of three brothers, longing for silence, me chasing fireflies with Teddy. My life with James felt steady and safe and certain. There had been no sorrow, no need for sacrifice. I wondered what my grandmother would think if she could see us, holding hands as we climbed the marble steps. We stood across from one another, like reflections. The judge spoke a few words, and we were married. I gave my hydrangeas to a couple we met on the way outside. "It can be your something borrowed in blue," I said. "Pass it on." James and I beamed at each other. We were giddy. We toasted our marriage with pancakes and champagne at a nearby diner, and then we headed to the airport, and I flew back to New York, and James to London. I would move to London a few months later, strangely enough, on a New Year's Eve. This time, instead of crossing the Pacific, I was crossing the Atlantic. And instead of Drew, it was James. A mirror. On the plane, there was no countdown to midnight. It was as though we were suspended above time again. And I knew that when I landed, it'd be morning. A beginning. I moved into James's small studio with two suitcases of belongings. I spent my days walking through Hyde Park and the halls of the Victoria and Albert Museum. I looked at the gathered items and wondered at these objects, so fragile, that had somehow been preserved through time. A collection of hand mirrors, a pen, a piece of cloth. If my life were a collection of objects, I didn't know what they would be. I felt like I'd been untethered, but was now linked to the world through James. I knew he wouldn't let me go. At our London wedding for our family and friends a year later, our first dance was a swing dance to Ray Charles. James wore braces, and I twirled around the dance floor in trainers. We served bourbon and cut glasses. The night shone like a jewel. It wasn't a fairy tale. I still had nightmares. Nightmares so vivid that I wake up covered in sweat as though I'd been running. I'd wake up convinced I was still in Hong Kong, that I was still with Drew, and I'd scream and shout as though I was being suffocated. James was patient. He'd listen to me, and he'd remind me gently of our life together. We'd talk until I was no longer afraid. It's evening. I can tell because it's medication time. I stand in line and obediently swallow the bitter liquid, knowing to chase it with a cup of Sunny Delight this time. My eyes are heavy and my mouth is dry. I wait to see if James will call again, but when I lift the receiver, there's no dial tone. Someone comes in and shuts off the lights in the TV room, and one by one, we shuffle out. The worker in front of my room makes a note on her clipboard, and she nods at me as she closes the door. Even though I know it isn't, it feels like my first night in the ward. I feel aware of the sounds, the silences, the sheets. I stand silently by the bed, unsure if I should undress. A part of me moves mechanically as I brush my teeth, jamming my toothbrush in the divot by the sink to make the water run. The fluorescent lighting is harsh against my skin, and I express milk into the sink quickly with shaking hands. I keep my clothing on. The sweater feels reassuring, familiar. The sheets scratch against my cheek, and I feel a sudden ache for home, my own bed. There's a sliver of light from the outside hallway. I can hear slamming doors. Someone is screaming. There are muffled shouts. My door opens, and I close my eyes and lie still and tensed. The door closes again, and I let out my breath as I realize it was probably a worker doing a head count. I am weary, my body is heavy, and I can feel my eyes closing. I try to think of home. I try to think of before, how I got here, but it feels raw, an exposed tangle of thoughts. What would I be doing if I wasn't here? I think of Cato. I have a glimpse of him in my mind, and I have a memory, a feeling, an imprint of holding a baby in my arms. I try to picture his face, but my body folds with an ache so hard it is like a part of me is hollow. I retreat from it and am thankful for the dark. I decide to pay more attention to my surroundings. The workers' faces are blurred. I learn them first by their hairstyles, and then eventually their faces as they come in focus. Most of the workers are immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa. They speak English with a hard lilt. Sometimes they laugh with one another and speak in their own languages. There's Jean, with a blunt bob and straight bangs. She is tough with a take-no-bullshit attitude. She speaks with a snap in her tone, but she's also one of the most generous on the ward. She buys treats for us with her own money, bringing them out in the cafeteria with a stern look and a pretend reluctance. Her attitude and sympathy for us make me wonder if she grew up in the system. There's Nona, with thin, wavy dark hair and a voice like a bird's. She was the one to first take me to the shower room, stripping my clothes off and chattering to me in broken English. "No, no," she'd shouted at me when I tried to turn the tap for the water. She handed me a toothbrush, which I jammed into a divot in the side of the shower tap in order to turn on the water. It was icy. "Breasts, breasts," she shouted, gesturing at me to press them. I did so gingerly. The knots were deep and swollen. "You have to get better so you can go home to baby," she said. None of them seemed fazed by us, and I know the other residents respect that about them. The only exception is Claire, a young blonde nurse who is on rotation. She is nervous around us. We can smell it. She doesn't look us in the eye and is careful not to let us brush past her. She often says the wrong thing. "Tamira, you're here again? I feel like every time I'm here, you're here too." She says it playfully and then falters. Mick stifles a smirk, and Tamira glares and then smiles falsely, too brightly. She starts to follow Claire around, stands as close as possible to her without touching. She sniffs Claire's neck. Claire freezes. She acts like you would when faced with a rabid dog. Every morning, Claire takes our blood pressure and our heart rate. She sets up a chair in front of the glass enclosure and calls us over, one by one, checking our names off a clipboard. I sit on the chair, and she fusses around me quickly, like she doesn't want to do the wrong thing. I want to tell her to relax, and I smile at her, but she's carefully looking away from me, like I'm contagious. We are walking to lunch. Jenny is sitting on the floor, crying in the hallway. She's shivering so hard her mouth is moving. Jenny came in this morning. She's a pretty mother of two, in her early 30s, with dark teased hair and smudged eyeliner. She has two front teeth, but the rest are brown and rotted. When she came in this morning, she glanced around the room and then came over to speak to Emma and me. Jenny is white, and she has a job at Target. She uses this to hold herself apart from the others. I think she knows Tamira. They nodded at each other, but kept their distance. I wonder about all the residents in the ward. What would it be like if we'd met outside? I know they think of me as someone who doesn't belong. Not with my advanced degree, my brand name leggings. I have a home. I have someone waiting for me. I'm privileged. Even Jenny, with her rotted teeth and shaking hands, she's privileged. Sometimes the others look at me in a way that makes me feel guilty. I'm lucky. I know it. I see you, Ollie had said to me again this morning. I see what you're doing. You're being smart. I don't ask what he means because I know. He's doing the same thing. We don't belong. We keep our heads down. I think of this as I see Jenny shivering on the floor. You okay? Will asks. Jenny shakes her head while shivering. They won't give me my meds, she says. When we come back out of the cafeteria, the paramedics are here. We see Jenny on the floor. Step back, one of the workers says. What's happened? Emma asks. She's sliding in her socks. I think she's had a seizure, Will says quietly. Step back, the worker repeats. The paramedics are standing over Jenny, blocking our view. They act like they can't see us watching. Dessert today is sliced canned pineapple. My mother used to tell me that when my grandfather was drunk, he would go buy cans of pineapple. It was a luxury, and my grandmother would scold him and cry. How would she feed the children this week? But my mother would clap her hands. Pineapple. When I was sick, my mother would crush Tylenol and orange juice to cut the bitterness and give me slices of pineapple circles in a crystal dish. She would never have any, though. Tamira doesn't want mine, and so I eat it as slowly as I dare, savoring the sweetness on my tongue. Darren joins me at the activity table. His eyes keep darting around the room, and his hands are shaking. There is a Chinese checkers board on the table. Ma'am, you know how to play? He asks. I nod. Do you want me to teach you? I ask. He smiles, and for a moment his handsome face looks like a child's. Emma still avoids him, ever since he lunged at her, and I notice that the others keep their distance. I don't know if it's gang-related, but then I wonder if I'm being prejudiced by automatically assuming he's in a gang. One of the Hispanic patients referred to Darren as Trayvon, which I recognize as a reference to his dark hoodie. Behind Darren's smile, I can glimpse a volatile light, as though there's something just out of reach, waiting to be uncaged. He is shy around me, as if I'm fragile, and he speaks to me like I'm a headmistress. The Chinese checkers pieces are neon colors, too bright, and both of us shade our eyes from the board. I can't remember the rules, and so I teach the game wrong. I can't remember if you can jump forwards or backwards, but we move the pieces along the board, and Darren laughs whenever he jumps one of mine. There is a moment when he looks upset that I jumped one of his pieces, and he seems tensed. A muscle in his jaw twitches, but then he looks at me and sticks out his tongue playfully and relaxes. He your brother? He asks me. My brother? He nods and points at Haru, who is coloring in a unicorn. Haru looks half Asian. I'm not sure how long he's been on the ward, but he acts as though he lives here. He is sweet and deliberate, but he can throw a tantrum when it's time for criminal intent. That's his show and he never misses it. Haru looks confused. You thought I was her brother? He looks at me. Am I? No, I say. No, Haru, we aren't related. Ollie's family comes in to the ward. They have weary eyes, and they sit at the conference table in the activity room with Christine, the social worker. Ollie paces and then stands by the glass. I can see that Ollie looks like his father, tall and lean. His father has an arm around Ollie's mother, who wears a veil and keeps her eyes on the ground. Neither of them glance in his direction. It's like he doesn't exist. Is that your family? Mick asks. He's wheeled his wheelchair up to the glass. Yeah. Are they okay? No, they're worried, man. They're worried. Mick nods. Ollie looks like a child, waiting for someone to nod and say hello. His parents leave without looking at him. I look for him later, but he's lying in his room. When he comes out for dinner, his eyes are red and swollen. I learn from group that not everyone has family who are waiting for them or helping them to get out. That is a rarity. There is Mick, whose brother is helping him, but who doesn't want to be saddled with him once he's out. Don't blame him, Mick says gruffly. Tamira's boyfriend is watching her kids. He calls her once a day, but she doesn't always answer the phone. Tell him I'm busy, she says, and rolls her eyes. Emma's father calls her every few hours while the phone is on. I'm guessing he also has an avocado. We don't talk about how we're going to leave. That would mean acknowledging that there is a world outside. But I know everyone is thinking about it. They must be, I think. I can sense that the question of how to leave is not something I can ask. The returners seem to know, but they don't share the information with us, and they watch silently as Emma flips through her papers and shows me a new form that she's filled in. Emma is the only one who talks about leaving, her strategy, her countdown. I'm going to move up to level 2, she says. I just need someone to sign this. It says that I've made a new friend. I have to get 3 signatures. Will you sign it? My avocado is going to get us all out of here, she says. All of us. The only one who seems to believe her is Dave. He trails her in his wheelchair. The others ignore her. We act like we are meant to be here, like we've just happened to appear. We are existing in this place, with nowhere else to go. I stare at the doctors and workers standing behind the glass, but they are careful not to meet my eyes. And when they look up, they look through me as though I'm transparent. I give up after trying to linger by the glass enclosure. I imagine myself shouting at them, "Let me out! Let me out!" I know that would just be a ticket to stay. I am coloring a lion in purple Crayola marker. Next to me, Emma is filing through her papers yet again, trying to stick tabs on them, an impossible task as she's using tissues. Catherine, Jeff says, your husband is here. I hear Tamira hiss. I look around me, but no one else stands up for visiting hour. I walk through the hallway, counting my steps. There are 54, one foot after the other towards the cafeteria door. For a moment, I'm afraid of who I will see. Will it be Drew? But it's James's anxious face in the window of the cafeteria door. He looks haggard, but he's beaming. Are we allowed to touch? I ask. Yes, Jeff nods. James embraces me. It's like he's brought in air from the outside, oxygen. I take a deep breath in and try to ground myself in James, in the certainty that is him. I can feel the past and present. It feels secure, a foundation, and I want to disappear in his arms. I hear murmurs. I see Emma and Mick. They also have visitors, but all I can do is focus on James. James isn't speaking. He's just holding my hand. We sit, and I'm just breathing in this moment. Thank you for the sweaters, I say. What are you wearing, I ask. Do you have enough clothes? Stop it, he says. Stop worrying about me. Did you get the notebook? Yes, I say. He tells me that he's been calling the ward every day, many times a day, working on getting me out, asking about my status. I've been making myself a pain in the ass, he says. I laugh because I know that he's been approaching this the way he would one of his research projects. He was the one to think of leaving me a notebook, which he had to lobby for, and he argued for them to give me a pen. He dropped off my glasses when he realized I didn't have them with me. I've been handling the insurance, he says hesitantly, so don't worry about that. He tells me that he's been on the phone to the UK, to my GP to get my paperwork released. He's been on the phone with the travel insurance companies, trying to log into my computer and credit cards with my combination of passwords. His words make me think of the outside world, how it's continuing on, all the logistics and mechanisms. Somehow it keeps going. Don't you want to know about Cato? He asks. Yes, how's Cato? I'd forgotten. The name doesn't have significance to me. He's good, he's good. They wouldn't let me bring a phone in, but I printed some photos of him for you. He hands me a stack of photos. I glance at them. I see a chubby-faced baby with wide eyes. I don't recognize him. I tuck the photos in the pocket of my hoodie. I spoke to the nurses. You can keep them with you, James says. I told them it would help you. He pauses. Do you remember what happened? We don't have to talk about it now, he says quickly. I remember a lot, I say, but it's confusing. He waits. I drew a family tree, I offer. He starts to cry. I feel a twinge of something, but I don't know what to do, so I just pat his hand. It's just that we kept trying to get you to draw one, but you couldn't. Visiting hour is over. It feels like we've just sat down. Time's up. Jeff says it gruffly, but his eyes are soft. Let's wrap things up, guys. James sighs. He holds my hand until the last moment. He smiles widely, but I can see that he's still crying. I'll see you soon, I promise. He walks towards the doors while waving to me, and he's still looking at me, waving to him when they close. It occurs to me that I didn't ask him how long I'd have to stay. They shuffle us out of the room, back to the ward, back to the waiting place. There is one Korean fairy tale about romantic love. Chiknyo, a sky maiden, falls in love with a herder, Kyonu. She glimpses him from across the Milky Way. She begs her father, the Sky King, to let them be married. Her father agrees. The lovers are married. They are so happy and in love that they neglect their duties. In anger and to punish them, the Sky King orders them to live apart. But he shows one act of mercy. On the 7th day of the 7th month of each year, they will be allowed to meet. When the 7th day of the 7th month arrives, the lovers are desperate to see one another, but they cannot cross the Milky Way. A flock of magpies form a bridge for the lovers to meet. And so each year, for one night, the lovers are reunited. This night marks the start of the rainy season. If it rains on that night, it is meant to be the couple's tears. I found out I was pregnant on a gray day in February. My period was late, but I was convinced it was a fluke. I decided to take a pregnancy test, thinking that once I'd spent money on the test, my period would come with a vengeance. Instead, it read positive. It was a Tuesday morning, and my husband was straightening his shirt, headed to a work meeting. I wasn't sure how to feel. I was 30 years old, the same age as my mother when she had me, and the same age as my grandmother when she had my mother. It felt preordained. The idea of being a mother had always felt vague to me. I knew it was something I wanted, but I never thought deeply about it. It was an idea, something I'd had to imagine, and now it was real. I made an appointment with the GP. It was 5 weeks. The baby was a mass of cells, the size of a poppy seed. When we told our parents, my mother was in disbelief. Really? She said. My father didn't comment. James's parents screamed and clapped. How wonderful, they said. How wonderful. I started counting time in weeks. Each week was a new fruit. I watched my body swell from poppy seed to watermelon. We went to the appointments, the ultrasound scans. I tested positive for gestational diabetes, and so for several times a day, I had to prick my finger on a paper strip and count my blood sugar levels. Each time I collected a drop of blood, I thought of Snow White, and I wondered what I should wish for my child. When I found out I was having a boy, I thought of Drew. Actually, I thought of Leah, and for the first time, instead of anger, I felt sympathy. How would it feel to have something of my own creation, a beautiful thing, become twisted and dirty and abusive? The poisoned part of me, the part I'd taken from Drew, was it still there? Would it infect the baby? I'd read that an ancestor's experience is imprinted in the DNA of the next generation, a warning for what was to come. Was violence there? Was an acceptance of suffering? Would my son be afraid of heights? Would he have nightmares of suffocating? How were we meant to exit the loops of the past if we were destined to face them again and again? I thought of my family, my own ancestors. They were a mystery to me, one that I didn't know about, separated by language and ocean. I only knew them in my own features. I wondered what my grandmother felt when she was pregnant with my mother, the fear, the hope for a son. For some reason, I thought that I would be having a girl, a third-generation daughter to pass on the stories, but perhaps this boy was an answer to my grandmother's wish, imprinted on generations. I held my hands close to my stomach and tried to feel the tiny beats of his legs, the pulse of his body, the reminder that he was alive, a living thing. James played music to my stomach. He'd read a study that music heard during pregnancy could calm the baby outside of the womb. We learned that Rachmaninoff made him jump and that he would do flips to Broadway musicals. It was strange to watch my skin ripple with each tug, a being doing somersaults inside. Pregnancy felt like a separation from the body. My body was doing something on its own, a pre-programmed path it already knew and I no longer had any control over. It felt like a hand sharply bringing my spirit back to my body, a return to the earthiness of it. It was also an erasure of self. I didn't feel more me. I felt like I was being split, being shared. My body was no longer my own. I was a carrier, a holder of life. It was a reminder that my body was a collection of blood and bones. "I like cervixes," a smiling midwife said to me while her hand was still inside me, performing my fourth membrane sweep. I was induced 2 days before my due date. It was a decision made by doctors because of my gestational diabetes and the concern that the baby was measuring big. "We would have to break the shoulders," a doctor said to me helpfully. I learned that doctors had a way of saying horrific things matter-of-factly. I agreed to the induction. We checked into the hospital like we were checking into a hotel. We had luggage, a car seat for the baby, and a stack of books and magazines. We sat in the hospital room and listened to the hum of lights and beeping of monitors. I was taken to a bed in a ward with four other women. We were all waiting for our inductions. I was hooked up to machines to monitor my blood pressure and heart rate. The induction started with a pessary containing prostaglandin, a hormone that is meant to trigger labor. A midwife inserted the cotton wool in me, and I lay in the bed and wondered how it would feel to give birth. I could hear the shifting of women's bodies and the sounds of their monitors. Every few hours, a nurse would arrive to take my temperature and check my heart rate. I started having contractions quickly. I watched the waves on the monitors, the small swells that corresponded to the tightening of a fist around my body. "You have a high pain tolerance," one of the midwives said to me cheerfully. "Look," she pointed at a wave that was reaching a high peak. "Maybe you should walk around. It will help encourage labor." I learned that the success of an induction is measured by the shortest route to labor. If the pessary didn't work, then I would have to have another pessary inserted after 12 hours. The induction process would keep escalating until a baby was born. James and I left the ward to walk the hallways, pacing back and forth along the corridor that loomed over us. There was no outside light, only the bright fluorescence of the hospital lights. It felt like an empty chamber. I walked, and every few steps I'd have to stop as a contraction took over. "Only 2 centimeters, a midwife said after checking how far I was dilated. "Can I give you another sweep?" I agreed and tried to relax as she moved her hand inside me. I was a body. I was strong. I could do this. Another pessary was inserted, and again I paced the hallways. We played a game of questions. "What qualities do you want him to have?" James asked. "I think you would say strength and kindness." "Yes, you're right. With strength and kindness, one could face the world." We had already chosen his name. James had chosen Cato for the Roman statesman, and I had chosen his middle name, Westbrook, for my godfather, a World War II veteran and linguistics professor. Strength and kindness. We paced slowly, while I stopped every few breaths to lean over and count until the waves subsided. I counted my steps, and I thought of those 1,000 steps in Hong Kong. What had I thought would happen if I'd been able to cross them? I thought of Qingyo walking over the magpies across the Milky Way to meet her love. Just one more step, I'd think. Just another. That's all that was separating me from becoming a mother. I still didn't know how it would feel. I couldn't imagine it. By the morning, I was dilated enough to start labor. We carried our luggage to another floor while I chatted with a midwife who talked about labor like it was a party. "We'll need to break your waters," she said. "It may be uncomfortable." I could tell from her voice that she was lying. She broke my waters with a long hook the size of an umbrella. I managed not to flinch. She hooked me up to more machines and a hormone drip to encourage more contractions. There was a clock on the wall, and I tried to count the hours, punctuated by the buzzing of the monitors and the waves of my contractions. I had an hour of strong contractions, ones that I tried to ride like waves. My husband held my hands as I breathed, in and out, and waited for the epidural. The epidural was a cold thread in my spine. My legs and feet were numb, but I could still feel them. The contractions felt like faint echoes. I could no longer feel the pain. The hours kept passing. My cervix had been checked so many times, I no longer dreaded it. My temperature and heart rate started to climb dangerously, and I developed sepsis. The midwife sat next to me, trying to hide the concern on her face as she counted the heartbeats. A doctor came and introduced herself. Why am I meeting a doctor? I thought. It's just in case we need to work together tonight. She introduced her whole team, an anesthesiologist, two junior doctors, a pediatric nurse. We'll be back, she said. I had a feeling that they knew that I would need a C-section. There was another hour, and the doctor returned to check my cervix again. You're only 4 centimeters dilated, she said, and it looks like it's not progressing. I think that the best way forward might be a C-section. What do you think? I noticed that her arm was dripping in blood. I agreed. Good, she said, and before I realized what was happening, her team rushed into the room and moved me onto a gurney. 1, 2, 3. Next to me, James had put on scrubs. Finally, we thought, finally, this was going to happen. Time seemed to flip forward. The team was sprinting with the stretcher, pushing me into an operating theater. You're going to feel cold, the anesthesiologist said. Do you have any loose teeth? I shook my head. Okay, the anesthesiologist said. She sprayed a bottle on me. Do you feel anything? No, I said. I started shaking and chattering uncontrollably. The anesthesiologist spoke calmly in my ear. Your stomach will feel like someone is looking for something in a handbag, she said. I remember the moment of seeing our son. He was red and squalling, and I remember thinking vaguely, are you sure? He didn't look like either of us. There were some concerns with his breathing, and James was running back and forth between me and the baby. I was dry heaving, trying to vomit into a bucket, still shaking uncontrollably. They took the baby to check his breathing, and I was wheeled to a recovery ward. I hadn't eaten since the night before, and I ordered a sandwich. There wasn't a bed for James, so he slept by me again in a chair. I had said to James before, isn't it funny how everyone says mother and baby are happy and healthy? What should we say? He asked the next morning. Just say that mother and baby are happy and healthy, I said. I understood why everyone said that. It was simpler.